last year, thousands of Bahrainis rose up, demanding political liberties, social equality, and an end to corruption. The government responded by brutally suppressing largely peaceful pro-democracy protesters. According to Human Rights Watch, Bahrain's human rights situation remains critical in the wake of this crackdown. They say that while King Hamad established an independent inquiry to investigate potential human rights abuses, it failed to fully implement the inquiry's recommendations, namely holding senior officials accountable for crimes such as torture or for failing to free protesters who were jailed for exercising their right to free expression and peaceful assembly. 21 of the most prominent dissidents still languish in prison, and no senior officials have been convicted of crimes, including dozens of killings that occurred during the crackdown last year. Opposition activists are still regularly detained or interrogated for speaking out. Human rights groups have also documented attacks on healthcare providers, denial of medical access to protesters injured by security forces, the siege of hospitals and health centers, and the detention, ill-treatment, torture, and prosecution of medics and patients with protest-related injuries. Early last month, an appeals court in Bahrain upheld the convictions of 9 doctors who had been accused of participating in and supporting unlicensed protests in a case that drew international condemnation and was seen as a crucial test of the government's commitment to political reform. Amnesty International has stated that, quote, these were politically motivated charges against medical professionals who were working to save lives amid very trying circumstances. Physicians for Human Rights, which has followed the case closely, denounced the verdict, noting that 18 of the 20 doctors charged in the case said they were tortured after their arrests. The group called on American officials to demand, quote, measurable improvements in the human rights situation, including holding anyone who engaged in acts of torture or ill treatment accountable. Clashes between protesters and police continue in Bahrain, as do reports of deaths from beatings and excessive use of tear gas. And the government continues to impose severe restrictions on access for international rights groups. Despite the government of Bahrain's violent crackdown and continuing human rights abuses, the United States resumed military sales to Bahrain in May of this year after a 7-month suspension. And the U.S. remained silent last month when 28 countries, including Mexico, Norway, Costa Rica, France, and Germany, condemned ongoing violations in Bahrain through a joint collective declaration calling for implementation of all the recommendations, including the release of political prisoners of the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, appointed by King Hamad following street demonstrations early last year. The group of states also called upon Bahrain to ensure accountability for those in government who have committed abuses. The United States decided not to support this joint initiative. Here to talk with us about the ongoing uprising in Bahrain, the human rights situation there, and U.S. foreign policy toward the island nation is Professor of Politics and Chair of Mideastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. Stephen Zunes. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Let's start with your response to the recent decision by the United States to resume arms sales to Bahrain. The administration has stated that these weapon sales would not include arms used for crowd control, like tear gas, and they also say that security challenges in the region required the sale. They've tried to frame this as an attempt to support Bahrain's crown prince, who was visiting Washington at the time the decision was made, and he is seen as representing a reform-minded faction in the government. So these are the arguments they're making to support this decision to resume arms sales. What is your response?
It sounds pretty weak to me, frankly. For one thing, they did not specify what kind of weapons they were sending the government. So it could very well include armed personnel carriers and other vehicles and equipment that have been used to support the repression against the pro-democracy protests. The sale was originally announced last fall, but it was suspended because of widespread protests by some members of Congress and human rights groups and others. But the administration continued selling arms under $1 million per transaction, which apparently do not have to be made public. But this resumption then seems like they are really but just basically spitting in the face of the human rights community, you know, by doing this. And then this whole idea of the strategic rationale. I mean, Bahrain's a tiny island. They're not minimal equipment in the world. They cannot defend themselves. But the fact is they are part of a military alliance with Saudi Arabia and other countries, which have substantial military hardware and armed forces. They are the host of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, U.S. Navy, that controls about 20% of the island. And so, you know, we have the presence of the U.S. military there. So the idea that they, on top of all the Saudi and U.S. and other support for their defense, they need additional equipment themselves, just kind of rings pretty hollow. And so I really think this is the rationale for the arms transfer is pretty weak, frankly.
The U.S. is continuing to condemn the crackdown of the Syrian government on people rising up there, as well as the U.S. supported anti-Mubarak protesters in Egypt and decided to use military force in Libya to help overthrow Gaddafi. But at the same time, the U.S. government is not only failing to forcefully condemn gross human rights abuses in Bahrain, but resuming arms sales to that nation. I'm wondering what you think is behind this.
Yeah, well, actually, U.S. did not support the pro-democracy struggle in Egypt. We endorsed it at the very end when Mubarak had fled. But I think it just it does underscore the as you're saying the double standard, particularly when it includes Syria and Libya, and the president President Obama has made a number of statements criticizing the repression in Bahrain, but he hasn't called for leaders step down as he has with Syria. He has not even called for substantial reform in the form of a constitutional monarchy or more accountable governance. And while even when the president and some others and some people in the State Department have spoken out against the repression, you get other signals from the Department of Defense and others who have told the government essentially not to worry, don't take this too seriously. We still support you. And so, the message has at most been mixed, but this is not missed by people in the Middle East. It really underscores that, despite the rhetoric we've been hearing originally back in the Bush administration about how the U.S. supports democracy in the Middle East, that when it comes to strategic allies like the Bahraini monarchy, there's really not that interest in following through.
Now, in documentaries such as Bahrain, Shouting in the Dark, which was produced by Al Jazeera English last year about what happened in Bahrain, they were there for much of the protests in February and March. They reported that doctors and nurses, political leaders, even sports stars, human rights activists, were arrested, in many cases tortured, and then some of them got very extensive prison sentences. There's some human rights activists who've been sentenced to life in prison, and as I mentioned in the introduction, some doctors and nurses who are facing years in prison for simply treating injured protesters. What has been the United States government response to these kinds of abuses?
Well, the Undersecretary of State for Human Rights, Michael Posner, has formally registered protest against this kind of repression. He was actually in the country at the time the convictions of the medical personnel were upheld. But again, there's no real follow-through. And we can wag our fingers all we want, but if the Bahraini regime knows it will be continued to get U.S. Economic and military support, they really don't have that much of incentive to change. And one of the real ironies, tragic ironies, is that in certain ways, Bahrain had more than virtually any country in the Arab world the potential for a genuine democratic transition. They have a sizable, educated middle class. This is a country that, even before the discovery of oil, was relatively well off as a major trading center and pearl diving center. They're not tribal. They are. They never had a large traditional landholding elite. This is a country of merchants and traders. It's Manama, which is the capital. I've been to Bahrain. Is quite an amazing city. Then we'll see Sunni mosques, Shia mosques, Hindu temples, Sikh temples, Christian churches, and even a Jewish synagogue. It was the first country in the Arab Gulf to provide women with higher education. In fact, if you go back to the 9th century, the island for close to 100 years was ruled by this Islamic socialist system where people, you know, shared wealth, there was social equality. I mean, it was a pretty one of the most egalitarian, idealistic societies in human history. In fact, there is a progressive tradition in that country, which has been held back by this monarchy, which originally came from Saudi Arabia, what's now Saudi Arabia, from Arabian mainland, a couple hundred years ago, and the British essentially set them up to be the colonial rulers during the time it was a British protectorate, and the U.S. is, especially since moving in the Fifth Fleet there in the early 1990s, has tightened its relationship as well. They are like the first country in that area to get a free trade agreement with the United States. The regime is basically even depending on outside forces, Western countries, to prop it up. And even though they have a lower house of parliament, which is elected, gerrymandered in a sense to favor pro-regime people, the upper house is appointed. Any legislation can be vetoed by the king with no overriding capacity. So it is not a democratic system, as much as people there would want to be, and I think really have the potential of making it so.
Well, what about the fact that there is a, as you mentioned, Sunni minority and monarchy ruling the country, but a sizable population of foreign nationals that have been brought in from Pakistan and other countries by the ruling family to bolster them?
Well, most of the oil wealthy countries there have foreign nationals in a number of the countries, like Kuwait and Qatar and United Arab Emirates. They're actually the majority of the population. They have absolutely no rights. They're very exploited. The situation in Bahrain is different in that indigenous Bahrainis are still the majority. But the regime has used some of these foreigners, particularly Pakistanis, in enforcing roles in the police and military, and they've granted citizenship to quite a few of them, in part to increase the percentage of the population that are Sunni Muslim. The majority of the population is Shia. The royal family and virtually all the major cabinet posts are held by Sunnis. And so some people have tried to exaggerate this as a sectarian conflict, as a Sunni versus Shia thing. And by extension, being Shias, people are claiming that, they're being supported by Iran. Iran's stirring up trouble. I even heard Obama's head Middle East advisor make those kinds of comments at a talk in Washington, D.C. about a year ago. But in fact, as the Bahrain government's own inquiry pointed out, Iran is not playing a role in supporting the opposition. And it's not a sectarian conflict. There are many progressive Sunnis who are involved in the pro-democracy struggle as well. And the Shias there tend to be more of the quietist tradition. They don't tend to follow Ayatollahs like Khamenei and the others. And they're also very nationalistic. I mean, Iran, back when it was Persia, controlled Bahrain for a period of time. And these people, the Shias, are just as Arab as the Sunnis are. And they don't want to be part of Iran or closely tied to Iran. In fact, it's rather interesting that just as people have tried to make the Syrian conflict into a kind of a sectarian struggle, the reality is that the predominantly Shia pro-democracy struggle in Bahrain has gone on record in solidarity with the predominantly Sunni pro-democracy struggle in Syria, and vice versa. That both of these movements, say, despite efforts to depict them as sectarians, they're just struggling for their basic freedom. Now, having said that, the reality is that because the Sunni-dominated minority government has discriminated against the Shia majority, you know, that you do have a disproportionate number of Shias in the movement. The government has condensed a lot of Sunnis to support the government and out of fear of what a Shia majority government would do. And so there are certainly some people who do look at it on a sectarian level. And within the broad pro-democracy movement in Bahrain, you do have some more hardcore chauvinistic Shias among them, certainly. But that's not the thrust of the movement. That, is a legitimate pro-democracy struggle, as we've seen elsewhere in the Arab world. And this effort to depict it as a sectarian conflict is really disingenuous.
You said that Bahrain was one of the countries best equipped to make a democratic transition. So what is the main thing standing in the way of this? You said the monarchy.
Well, the press is a force of the monarchy, but the big thing that made the difference was the invasion by Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
Bahrain is an island, but it's connected to the Arabian Peninsula by a causeway. In fact, Saudis like to go to Bahrain to party on weekends. There's actually a Saudi expression that God does not see what happens in Bahrain. In other words, it's easy to get across the causeway, and indeed, you had armored columns from Saudi Arabia to come in to crush the rebellion without apparent complaints by the United States. I mean, can you imagine the reaction, by contrast, of Iran sending troops to back up Syria and suppressing the struggle there?
Yeah.
But, Saudi Arabia, of course, is a close U.S. ally, and these are U.S. supplied weapons primarily. And so it was, ended up being basically a result of this outside interference. And just to give you an idea of just the pettiness of the regime, they ended up, the big symbol of the resistance had been the Pearl Roundabout. It's a statue, modern sculpture with a big pearl at the top. That's been around for many, many decades, and it sort of symbolizes the city and the country, much as the Eiffel Tower would be for Paris or whatever. But because it became this rallying cry of the opposition, the government ended up tearing down this famous sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they even withdrew from circulation a coin that had the statue on the backside.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're just being as thorough as they can to eradicate any symbol of this popular resistance movement.
What about the role of the United States? So if the United States had been, instead of fairly weak in its response, what if the United States government had taken an approach similar to what they're taking in Syria, for example?
I think it's not a situation where, the opposition needed aid and support. They're the majority. They could have done it themselves. But what the United States should have done, certainly, was to have just made it very, very clear to the Bahrainis that if they wanted to have any strategic relationship with the United States whatsoever, they had to end the repression. And similarly, they needed to tell the Saudis in no uncertain terms that no U.S. equipment could be used in this act of aggression against their Bahraini neighbor. And the United States could have allowed the U.N. Security Council to go ahead and condemn the Saudi aggression and place on sanctions where appropriate. I mean, there are a whole number of things that the United States could have done. In most of these cases, we've seen scores of situations where even the most repressive regime has been brought down through the power of large-scale strategic nonviolent action. And we could have seen a similar thing in Bahrain, I believe, if the United States and Britain had not continued their backing for the Bahraini and Saudi regimes in the crackdown against the country's people.
And the reason why the U.S. didn't respond this way is because we have a major military base there, because
that's part of it. Even though the protesters, were not demanding that the U.S. get out, although I must say that there, because of the U.S. support for the regime, there is really for the first time a growing sense of anti-Americanism in the country. But they are willing to keep up the strategic relationship with the United States. That wasn't the problem. I think more the problem was is that the United States was concerned for instability. They were afraid that Iran, might be in an improved position by having a government that, while not allied to Iran per se, doesn't share quite the level of hostility that the current government does. I think they were concerned about the Saudis and how they react. I mean, I think the Saudis, frankly, were less concerned about the precedent of a majority Shia Arab country there in the Gulf, as they were the prospects of a majority government. Period, a democracy, and that's a kind of scary precedent for the ruling monarchy of that country. And given, of course, the importance of Saudi Arabia as the major supplier of oil to the United States, as the strongest regional challenge to Iran in the Persian Gulf, and as the recipient of many, many billions of dollars every year of contracts from construction firms, Bechtel, the oil companies, the arms industry, the U.S. Didn't want to jeopardize their relationship with the Saudis.
What about their relationship to the monarchy in Bahrain? You've written about and you've spoken about it today, the free trade agreements that they have with that government.
Yeah, very friendly environment to American firms, American trade. It was one of the very first places in the Middle East where U.S. oil interest began way back in the 1930s, so there's a long-standing history there. And I remember actually interviewing Admiral Crow when he was had the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain. We met in the U.S. Embassy, and let me just mention the U.S. Embassy has to be the largest U.S. embassy in the world relative to the size of the country. It's a huge fortress-like structure. And I remember Admiral Crowe telling me that man for man, pound for pound, the Bahrainis are the most important allies the United States has. Which underscored how the United States sees the importance of this the relationship with the Bahraini monarchy.
And yet most ordinary Bahrainis are not pleased with these policies.
No. And again, the relationship with the United States was like a lot of Arab countries, a lot of Muslim countries, there was they definitely had issues around Palestine, around Iraq, and other things, but it was not a hotbed of anti-Americanism. The U.S. support for the regime, for the repression, has definitely soured attitudes.
But the U.S. may have feared that if there was a change in power, that a new government in Bahrain or a more democratic Bahrain might not be so favorable to economic
policies.
Exactly.
Again, they would not flip and be pro-Iranian and extreme anti-American, but they'd certainly take a more independent foreign policy. They would certainly pursue a foreign policy where they put their perceived needs domestically ahead of those of the United States.
And similar with economic policies.
Exactly, very, very much so. Again, because the Shias are the poorer sector part of the population, and they have seen how a disproportionate amount of the country's wealth has gone to not just the royal family, but the Sunni minority. They have seen how the regime and its cronies have been able to seize some of the best land in the island, which is it's very limited in terms of land. Certainly a democratic government there, would pursue economic policies that might not be as much into this kind of neoliberal, free market, free trade, kind of direction that the United States seems to prefer.
What, with human rights organizations still being limited with their ability to do work in Bahrain, It's hard to know the exact human rights situation, but what is your sense of the current situation there? Things have improved, have they not, since the major crackdowns last year?
Well, I mean, it's improved in the sense that, you know, not as many people are getting killed or beaten or tortured, but that is in large part because the repression was essentially thorough enough and scared enough people and intimidated enough people that they're less willing to confront the regime more directly. Now, there's still resistance, but they're smaller acts of resistance, like little impromptu smaller demonstrations where people would, you know, retreat in a hurry. Other things that show that people are still upset at the system, but they realize that with the Saudi and other forces in the country, and the regime's ability to be so brutal, and the failure of the United States or other countries to support the pro democracy struggle, that they have to lay pretty low.
But hasn't there been some reforms? Hasn't the Bahraini government instituted some reforms? And they did have the Independent Commission of Inquiry that was praised.
They have opened up in some areas. Some charges have been dropped against some of the protesters, and there's a degree of judicial review. They've taken some of the cases out of military courts and put them into civilian courts. Most, though by no means all, of the political prisoners have been released. Yeah, there has definitely been some reforms, but they still have fallen way short of the recommendations of the government commission, and way short of what human rights groups have been calling for.
And there are still human rights activists and people from the media, journalists, doctors, and others in prison, some of whom have gotten life sentences, right?
Yes, you know, very, very much so. A handful of people are serving long sentences for engaging in acts of violence, you know, Molotov cocktails and attacks on security personnel. But the vast majority are jailed for purely non-violent political offenses.
And there's some prominent human rights activists who have received life sentences.
Yes, and there's been hunger strikes and other protests. In some cases, family members have been arrested as well, and they have protested relatives' detention and treatment. Yeah, it's not a good situation.
So what can ordinary Americans do who are concerned about the fact that our government continues to support the Bahraini government with arms and with close ties and refuses to join other nations when they speak out? What can people do if they're concerned about the fact that there are still people who are in prison there for some, again, life sentences for simply taking part in pro-democracy demonstrations and calling for a change in government there, and not to mention all the torture that has been documented by multiple human rights organizations and the targeting of doctors and nurses who are simply treating the injured, etc. What can ordinary American citizens do that want to influence our government to take a different stance?
I think it was what the American people have done on other occasions. On such issues as Indonesia's occupation of East Timor back in the 1990s, about U.S. support of various Latin American dictatorships in the 1980s, and in other cases of speaking out about it, getting people to know about it, protest vigils, writing to Congress, the usual kind of thing, because rarely do members of Congress take initiatives to challenge U.S. Foreign policy unless they are being pressured to. The representatives for this area, Sam Farr and Ann Eshoo, have been better than a lot of people on human rights, but I am not aware of either of them speaking out on this issue. And unfortunately, they both ended up supporting a resolution that among other things, had a clause condemning alleged Iranian manipulation of instability in the Middle East, which many of us interpreted as making reference, though it didn't mention Bahrain by name,
mm-hmm.
of appearing to justify the U.S. interpretation that the struggle is one of Iranian influence and not a pro-democracy struggle. So I think certainly putting some pressure on our own members of Congress in this area would be important. But I think it's also one thing to emphasize that there is a tendency, from people from a variety of political persuasions to try to put many of these struggles into a kind of geopolitical context about who gains and who loses, in terms of the United States or Russia or Sunnis or Shias or whatever. And I think we really need to focus, whether it be Bahrain or Syria or Yemen or anywhere else, that this struggle is about human rights. The struggle is about the people who want a more democratic, open system. And the kind of democracy that will emerge in Bahrain or anywhere else will be influenced, of course, by each country's unique cultural and historical conditions. But this desire to be free is universal, and the desire to be free is growing. And the United States, even putting aside the moral and legal questions about support of the regime, is placing itself on the wrong side of history here. And I think that is something that's really important to emphasize, because sooner or later, the people of Bahrain will win, and the monarchy will either fall or have to be substantially reformed. And the question is going to be, when the Bahraini people look back, who are their friends and who are their enemies? And if the people in Washington are so obsessed about the security interest in the Gulf region, the last thing we want to do is to alienate this younger generation, who are sooner or later going to be the new leadership of their country.
I think one of the problems with the situation in Bahrain, at least from the perspective of, people here having any knowledge of it, is just that it didn't get nearly the attention in the mainstream news outlets that events in Syria and other countries are involved in.
This is fairly typical. I mean, it's always been the case that human rights abuses by U.S. allies are often downplayed, ignored, while human rights abuses by regimes opposed by the United States are publicized, in some cases even exaggerated. But the effect of the media blackout on Bahrain is profoundly disappointing, though I guess not totally surprising. And it's been, but there's been some good coverage in some of the more alternative media. And by those who focus on the Middle East, but it's definitely one that we need to know more about.
What news sources do you turn to primarily?
Well, you mentioned that outstanding documentary by Al Jazeera English, which is free and downloadable on the web, Sounding the Dark.
You can watch it on YouTube.
On YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's interesting that the Arabic language version of Al Jazeera has not had much, not had the greatest coverage, but the English language side has, and which is pretty remarkable, given that Al Jazeera is based in neighboring Qatar,
mm-hmm.
Another autocratic monarchy,
mm-hmm.
which has supported the crackdown, but apparently they gave at least the English language branch enough political space to be able to do this.
Interesting.
Coverage. Which has been quite good. I've always liked the work of the Middle East Resource and Information Project, MARIP.org.
Mm-hmm.
They've had some good things on Bahrain. I've had a couple articles on my website, stephenzunes.org, stephenzunes. And there's generally Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. They've kept good tabs on the human rights situation there. Democracy Now! Has had a couple of decent episodes dealing with Bahrain as well.
Mm-hmm. And some of the British papers seem to have been doing
better.
Yes,
The Guardian, The Independent, and Observer have all had far more Bahrain coverage than you've found in the U.S. press.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll repeat those websites in a moment, but I just want to remind listeners that we've been talking with Professor Stephen Zunes about the ongoing uprising in Bahrain and U.S. foreign policy toward Bahrain. He is professor of politics and chair of Mideastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. And I just want to thank you for joining us today, Stephen, and thanks again for your time and your knowledge. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So again, those websites that Stephen mentioned, of course, his website, which is stephenzunes.org. And also he mentioned the website of the Middle East Research and Information Project. That's www.merip.org, M-E-R-I-P, merip.org. And of course, the Al Jazeera English documentary, Shouting in the Dark. You can watch that on YouTube. It's excellent. I highly recommend watching it. It's under an hour, and it's very engaging and well-produced. And I will warn viewers, though, that some of the images and information are disturbing, but I believe that it's something that we should see, considering that our government is supporting the Bahraini monarchy with weapons. As mentioned, resuming arms sales earlier this year and refusing to join other nations in condemning the crackdown there. So, again, those websites, merip.org and stephenzunes.org, and check out Bahrain Shouting in the Dark on YouTube. Thanks for listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.